we have been studying some about family and what God has said about that on Lord's Day evenings. And tonight we want to study about home and family, and particularly some about domestic relations. I would suggest to you that when we talk about the breakdown of the home, that what we are saying is something that all of us know something about. After all you have to do is look around us, and we see the home in a vast state of disarray, very sadly. And yet, whenever we say that the home is experiencing a breakdown, what we are saying or implying is that there is some norm by which the home is to be judged, that there is some standard, and that the home is not measuring up to that standard, but rather is falling short of that. And I think this is especially so in regard to the origin, the design, and the permanence of our homes. There is a great disparity in what Revelation has declared and in then what we are observing in reality. And it seems day after day produces new changes. That's not surprising, even sometimes sadly, in the Church of the Lord, because after all, men are modifying the language even of Revelation, and they are deviating from the divine pattern. And so it's not surprising to find that there are those who are advocating all kinds of arrangements that do not harmonize with the language that God has given, for example, about the purpose or the permanency of the home relationship. Whenever you try to think about what causes the problem of the breakdown of the home, I would guess that maybe one word that we could use could pretty well summarize that. And that's simply the word humanism. I realize that that is a word that we have used a great deal, say, within the last 5 to 7 years, and it is a subject about which a great deal of discussion has come in regard to the particular subject. But I would also suggest to you that it is not as new as the last decade insofar as its rise or its development. The truth is that the humanist philosophy has been around about as long as man has been around. And it begins with the idea that man alone is all that there is, that man becomes top dog, and God is pushed out of the number one place to look for information or wisdom or guidance, and as a result of that, man is in that position, and he decides to do that which appears to be right in his own eyes. I would guess that probably as good a picture of that as you were going to be able to get is seen there in Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, and continuing through the end of the chapter at verse 32, when Paul talks about the sins of the Gentiles. Because you remember that what they refused to do was to retain God in their knowledge. And when they did that, basically what they did was to put human wisdom and to put themselves in the place of God, and they then began to formulate their own gods, and they began to make their own rules and their own standards. And when they did so, they drew farther and farther away from God and His revelation. And that is really nothing more than the very idea of humanism. Humanism is as old as man, I suggest. Protagoras, one of the Greek philosophers, said that man is the measure of all things. And whenever you try to define it, basically it is a philosophy that, one, regards the rational individual as the highest value, two, considers the individual to be the ultimate source of value, and finally is dedicated to the fostering of the individual's creative and moral development in a meaningful and rational way without any concepts of the supernatural. In other words, what we have just said, God basically is removed either because, one, we don't believe there is a God, or two, because we're not sure that there is a God, and the thing that we are sure of is that we are and we exist, and therefore we have a right to chart our own course. And I would suggest that society is shot full of humanism, and it's seen in a variety of different places. In education, it's seen, for example, in the values clarification systems that they are so often trying to drill into our children, that is totally devoid of any principles of absolute standards of right and wrong, such as are contained in the pages of the Bible. And the very idea that there is some absolute standard to which all men are amenable is totally foreign to the thinking of these people. It likewise can be seen out here, even in some of our advertisements where, say, the fast food industry is concerned. And what you see is we're being told continually that you deserve a break today. Or sometimes you got to break the rules. And basically what that says is there isn't any standards out here. And whenever it becomes necessary to change them to suit yourself, or because you are the only one under consideration, then you go ahead and operate according to those principles. It's not surprising that that's become the measure of our society. After all, Joseph Fletcher introduced in his book, Situation Ethics, the very idea that man becomes his own God and that there are no absolutes. And Altizer, just a few years ago, came along and said that God is dead and that man, therefore, does not lean anymore upon the crutch called God or called deity. And all of this helped to set the stage for the breakdown in the family as the humanists began to attack the home and the family. I would suggest that if I stated that you would probably readily agree with it. But I want to read just a few quotations from several secular humanists tonight to demonstrate the kind of attacks that they are making on the family, that the kind of values about home and family life that most of us who are in this assembly take for granted, and that we cannot imagine anybody accepting any other standard whatsoever, is something that is not the majority of the thinking of the world, nor is it the basic teaching that even our children are going to get out in the education system. For example, Ray Barber, in his book Marriage and the Family, on pages 22 and 23, says this about the origin of the family. Now, I know one thing. Tonight, I wouldn't have very many difficulties in going around and saying, where did the family originate in this group, and getting an absolute definite answer, would I? I mean, after all you've got to do is turn to Genesis chapter 2 and begin reading in verse 18 and read through verse 24, and you get the origin of the family when God presented Eve unto the man, and we've talked about what he said. But listen to what Barber had to say. He says, what is the origin of the family? How did family life come into being? What was its earliest type? What was the prototype? These are questions that we cannot answer with certainty. We do not know. The impenetrable curtain of antiquity baffles the keenest eyes, and we can only speculate on the enticing mystery so effectively hidden from us. Here's somebody who says, we have no idea where the family originated or why it originated or when it originated, and there's no way of even beginning to know this. Do you see what they've done? They've totally ruled God out of the picture. So if you begin to establish the principles of God as it pertains to home and family kind of life, why, you're going to be scorned and scoffed at, because everybody knows nobody knows where the family originated. Furthermore, let me suggest to you that in Time magazine, sociologist Reuben Hill gives these seven functions, he says, that are a part of the family. Now, as I read what he says these seven functions that the family performs are, what I want you to do is look for God in these qualities. One is reproduction. Two, protection and care of children. Three, economic production of family goods and services. Four, socialization of children. Five, education of children. Six, recreation. And seven, the giving of affection. Let me ask you, where are the values of morality? Where is God in that? Where is religious education? It's not there. And do you know why? Because these folks in their humanist concept have no room for God in that. Man has become the epitome of it. The questioning begins then with, can the family survive? Students living in rebellion, young people living in communes, unmarried couples living together, all call in question the very meaning and structure of a family stable unit of our society as it has been known, says Margaret Mead. I suggest that basically what they're saying is, you just look out here at the way things are, and the family is in disarray, and in a few years, it's not going to exist anymore. In fact, psychologist Richard Farson said this, the family unit is now without function. It is no longer a necessary part of the basic unit of our society. Now, isn't that odd? As you read through the pages of the Word of God, the family and the home are the very basic function and structure of the family unit and of society. And as the home goes, so generally goes society. But now here's somebody who comes along and predicts that there just isn't any future where the family is concerned. Furthermore, a fellow by the name of Pitram Sorokin made this statement about husbands, wives, and marriage in the Ladies' Home Journal. He said, divorces and separations will increase until any profound difference between socially sanctioned marriages and illicit sexual relationships disappear. I think that's what they're desiring. They want to just come along and say that it doesn't make any difference if people are married or not married. If they want to have some kind of physical relationship one with another, they ought to be able to go ahead and do that. There ought not to be any guilt or trauma associated with that. The main socioculture functions of the family will further decrease until the family becomes a mere incidental cohabitation of male and female, while the home will become an overnight parking place, mainly, he says, for sex relationships. I think it's pretty obvious that this fella has only one thing on his mind, and he sees that that's the only purpose in the family ever having existed in the first place. And yet, when you pit that against this evaluation and observation, it sounds a little better. All of life owes a great debt to the home. Every good activity and institution was born within its walls. From earliest days, the home was the center of worship. The first industrial problems were parlayed there. Law and government began with parental authority and discipline. The beginning of hospitals began with home nursing. The seeds of democracy, education, culture, libraries, social clubs, and character-building enterprises found their inception in the family. You see, on the other hand, historians look at the family and say that many of the things that we enjoy out here as institutions that help us greatly in society today had their inception in the family. And yet somebody else comes along and says, no, the only reason the family exists is for the kind of cohabitation reasons. And if it wasn't for that, the family would disappear because it's an obsolete kind of a situation. I suggest to you, however, that the family is not pictured that way where God has so revealed in the pages of His Word. The bottom line in marriage and the home and the family is that it is the basic unit of civilized society. God says it has the very foundation of society. And this axiom has been recognized throughout history as the last statement just indicated. Now, it is true that when human weaknesses will pervert the wisdom of the Bible mind, what happens is that the family structure as God has ordained it becomes a millstone around the neck of society. And this is one of the five reasons that is given, is it not, for the fall of Rome. That is the rapid increase of divorce, the undermining of the dignity and the sanctity of the home, which was the very basis of human society. And so, the truth is, no society has ever survived after its family life deteriorated. And I guess that's one of the main reasons that we need to be so concerned about some of the problems that we're seeing today in the breakdown of both home and family. For you see, not only is this true out in our nation, it's worked its way into the church of the Lord. And there have been a great many problems, and the church has been weakened in many areas as a result of the difficulties that have come through the family structure. And we are not seeing the solid, stable family structures and units, even in the church, so often as we ought to be seeing them. And I would suggest then that sometimes this may be because there's a lack of persistent teaching along these lines. Sometimes I guess we just figure that by the process of osmosis, our children are going to grow up understanding the basic fundamental principles that God has given about home and family, or from hit and miss kind of efforts in classroom structures, or maybe once in a while from the pulpit where some of these things are enumerated or mentioned, that that's good enough. And it's not going to be good enough considering the attitudes that are out there in society and the kind of things that our children are going to be constantly encountering, even in their educational concepts. And at the same time, there's a great deal of the teaching that is done, especially in the world, by these worldly concepts. They view the family not with the same permanency, not with the same ideas of origin and goal that God has revealed in the pages of His Word. And so it becomes necessary that we strengthen these qualities where the family is concerned through our teaching. Now, the strength of any structure is found, I suggest, in the material or building blocks that are used to build that. And the building block of society is the home. Let me see if I can illustrate that. Back a number of years ago in our own country, Henry C. Grady, who was a prominent newspaper editor, during the days that the Capitol was being built in Washington, D.C., went to Washington just to observe some of the things that were there. On his way home later, he stopped in a private home and spent the night that was located in a very small community. During the evening, the family gathered for Bible reading and for prayer. And when he got back and wrote his editorial in regard to his trip, his opening lines were this: "I have been to the capital of the United States of America, but it was not in Washington, D.C. It is in the homes of this nation where the Bible is read and believed and where prayer is offered." And I believe he's absolutely right in that. The force and the strength of our nation does not rest in how many military installations that we have established wherever they might be. It does not credit itself by our nuclear arsenals and how well stocked and well supplied they are. It's not in the number of mighty fighting men that we are able to have at any given location or the brilliance of military minds. Basically, the strength of our nation depends on people like you and I. People who will read and study because we believe that the Bible is the Word of God and that we are seeking the information that God has delivered that we might live that in the lives that we try to live every day. It is seen in the strength that comes by virtue of prayers that are offered unto the Heavenly Father with the recognition that our dependence is upon Him and our confidence is in Him and that He will supply our every need. And I think indeed that whenever Grady wrote that article, that he was absolutely right. And you know, whenever you begin to look into the pages of the Bible, is it not true that in every dispensation of time in which you might want to look, that the family unit was emphasized by God? For example, when you look into the days of the patriarchal dispensation, and you look at the family unit, for example, of Abraham, you might notice in the 18th chapter of the book of Genesis and in the 19th verse, that when God looked at Abraham and commended him, it was not because of his ability with flocks and herds. It was not because of his courage and his willingness to use those who were trained servants in his own household to go forth after a mighty host and rescue, because of his great love for family, his nephew Lot. But rather, God made this statement about him: "For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they will keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring unto Abraham that which he hath spoken of him." God said, when I look at Abraham, the one thing that I see is that here is a man who is determined above everything else to try to instill in his family and in those who comprise his household servants and staff a recognition and a knowledge of God. He wants them to understand and to have the same kind of trust and confidence and faith in God that he has himself. And God says, it is for this that I'm going to accomplish in Abraham all of the promises that I've made to him, because his confidence and trust is in me. And that's why Abraham was such a man of faith. God's confidence was expressed in him because of what he would do in the family. Or I recognize that sometimes there may be some dispute about whether or not Job was in the patriarchal dispensation as a period of time that he lived in or not. It appears to me that certainly he was. But if you look at the first chapter of the book of Job in the first five verses, you find that in this activity of the patriarch of the family, Job certainly was interested in God and in his family. And that there were occasions where, by virtue of his concern for his children and what they may or may not have done, he was willing to go forth and offer sacrifice for them, lest peradventure in some of their merriment of life they may have sinned against God. Here was a man who took very serious the responsibilities that being the head of the family necessitated as he sought to instill the right kind of example even in that family. And you certainly see not only the patience, but the great faith of Job, though sometimes he calls in question, "Why me? Why have all these things befallen me? I don't understand this." There are a great many questions that he gives, and yet in all of this, you see that the scripture says, "Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly." And that says something about what he was able to do and his concern for family. When you look into the Jewish dispensation of time, I would guess that probably the best illustration that you can get there is found in the book of Deuteronomy. In the fourth chapter, in verses 4-9, you're able to look and see a very familiar passage about teaching and instructing the children. You know, I guess their day and time was vastly different than ours. And so much of the work maybe that they did was able to be done pretty close to home. They were able to be there, and the family might have been able to have gathered around. It may have been that sometimes some of those youngsters were there wherever it was Dad worked, whether at whatever occupation it may have been, and maybe were being taught from a very early age some of the trade that was Dad's. Notice that in the kinds of situations that this provided, that in verse 7 of Deuteronomy 6, God says, "And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." Notice that there was a responsibility that family had to the teaching of the next generation, the precepts of God. And you remember that in some of those great feasts that God gave to Israel, inevitably it was designed so that the upcoming generations might be able to be taught the meaning and the significance of these things. Whenever it would be that they would ask, "What meaneth this?" the patriarch of the family was the one who was responsible to answer that with the explanation as to whatever that feast or that monument or that memorial was supposed to be, so that the next generation would come to know God and put their trust and their confidence in Him. You might notice likewise in the 7th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy and in the first 5 verses, particularly in view of the fact that here, when Israel entered into the land, God established a definite marriage law that forbid marriage with those who were the inhabitants of the land. In verse 3, He says, "Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter shalt thou not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son." Let me ask you, was God here prejudiced? Was there some kind of racial slur that is being manifested here by God toward his people and those who dwelt in the land? There's a very honest and real explanation given as to why this kind of injunction is given in verse 3 in verse 4. He says, "For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly." Notice that the main reason God said that I don't want my people intermarrying with the people of the land is because of the great temptation to leave or forsake me and to pursue after the matters of idolatry. And so as a result of this, God forbid that. Israel often forgot this and instead intermarried with the peoples of the land. And for example, this was one of the reasons that they in Babylon ultimately came to understand that they had been carried away captive. And even when they are able finally, under the leadership of men like Ezra and Nehemiah, to come back and to try to rebuild at least the remnant that chose to return to Jerusalem and to the land of promise, and especially as they tried to rebuild the walls of the city of Jerusalem and tried to rebuild the temple there, that on one occasion they had a great ceremony where when they came to understand once again the law and they began to look among themselves, they found that they had already violated the command that is just given there in Deuteronomy chapter 7 verses 3 and 4. And they had a great ceremony where they put away those wives lest they be tempted into idolatry once again and once again suffer the consequences of some kind of captivity in another land out of which they'd just come. They had learned their lesson well in regard to that matter. When you come into the gospel dispensation, you most certainly see a great emphasis on the family, do you not? In Ephesians chapter 6 and in verse 1, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." Or in verse 4, "You fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord." In the 5th chapter of the book of Ephesians, relationships of husbands and wives are talked about. Primarily there, you're able to see Paul saying, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it." Or when you turn over to Titus chapter 2 and you begin to look at the instruction that older women are to give to younger women, one of those instructions center around the idea that the older women are to teach the younger women to love their husbands. So the love of family was a preeminent thing and revealed to us insofar as the gospel was concerned. God emphasizes the family unit. He says a great deal about that. That's why whenever the home is damaged, it is one of the greatest tragedies that is ever experienced. Peace and happiness most certainly are lost. There's a great amount of emotional turmoil and ruin that people undergo. And I just tell you, anybody that's had to go through the trauma of the breakup of family and home certainly does not want anybody else, if they can possibly help them to overcome that, to have to go through that whatsoever. There can be some staggering moral consequences. Inevitably, whenever a family breaks up, almost always you're going to find that there has been immorality, or there will be immorality very shortly where the picture is concerned. And then there are the disrupted and destroyed lives, quite often, of the children. What we have done in regard to these matters is we have sown to the wind and we have reaped the whirlwind. And what kind of principles then are there that we might look at in the last couple of minutes that will help us to understand something about what God says of the family that will be of a positive nature? Well, let me suggest just a couple of things. And that is that God has designed the family separately from the secular humanist viewpoint as a permanent arrangement. Permanent as it relates to its duration, that is. You know, whenever you look in the 10th chapter of the book of Mark and the first 12 verses, you find Jesus' instruction in regard to the matter of marriage. You will notice as you read Mark 10, and I'm not going to take the time to do it, verses 1 through 12, that the one thing that is missing in this passage is the exception. In other words, he does not mention what he talks about in Matthew 19 and verse 9. Basically, what Jesus is doing, I'm convinced, in Mark 10 verses 1 through 12, is he is establishing the rule. You will notice that what Jesus says there in Mark 10 verses 1 through 12 harmonizes perfectly with the origin of the family as Moses related that in Genesis 2 verses 18 through 24. And I think that what Jesus is trying to do here is something that often I try to do. I realize that we have to deal with the exception. The exception is there. It is a very real exception and it has to be dealt with. But I think sometimes we have worked so much on the exception that maybe unconsciously we have planted the seed of question in the minds of our young people that have said that maybe there is a way out of marriage and maybe it's not really designed to be a permanent situation, and that's not so. Whenever you learn any language, one of the things that you will quickly identify is the first thing you have to do is to learn the rule. And then, after you learn the rule, if there is any exception to that rule, you then learn the exception. And I would suggest that sometimes, in regard maybe to the study of marriage and divorce and remarriage, that what we have done is we have spent so much time with the exception that maybe we have not very well learned the rule. I also have generally learned that just about every marriage breakup is different from every other one. And the best I can do is just simply state this is what the Lord says in Matthew 19 and verse 9. And you're going to have to make the application insofar as the personal considerations are a part of your life, because you're the one that knows who the guilty and the innocent party, if there are such in that arrangement, are actually going to be. I would suggest to you, however, that what Jesus does here is to point out for us the rule. And notice what he says is that God's law has got to be respected. The rule is one man and one woman until death should separate them. And do you notice that what he says is that the man, singular, shall cleave unto his wife, singular. You see, Jesus really is, in that passage, working very diligently, trying to establish for us what the rule has always been from the very beginning. Now somebody says, well, what about the exception of Matthew 19 and verse 9? Well, let me suggest in application of that exception that there are several things that need to be considered. First of all, we need to be certain that fornication has occurred. Secondly, we need to be certain that the innocent party, as we so style them, are not responsible. Third, we need to be certain that fornication is the cause of the putting away. And we need to be certain that reconciliation is impossible. These are the kinds of considerations that have to enter into the individual who is evoking, as it were, the exception of Matthew 19 and verse 9. Now, the reason that there is this kind of disruption, at least in American society today, it seems to me, is the result of the easy divorce. You know, the staggering statistics are out there. 50% of all marriages end in the divorce court. And I ran across something that surprised me the other day. Maybe you've already seen it and it doesn't surprise you at all. But in our densely populated areas on both East and West Coast, that there it runs closer to 70% for people living in those areas. That's a staggering thought to imagine that. And nonetheless, that's what's being shown. What it says probably is that those of us who are in the heartland of America are doing a little better than that so that we can take it from that 70% to where it averages out to the 50%. You know, easy divorce has produced a lot of attitudes that ensure marital breakup. Many times young people do not think in terms of lifelong commitments or marriage as a lifelong contract. We have talked about the selection of a marriage partner. Young people, one of the things you need to do is to make sure through your discussions with whoever that is that you're contemplating marrying to find out, is their attitude about marriage that this is a permanent until death we do part arrangement? And I would suggest to you that if that is not their thinking about marriage, if that is not your thinking about marriage, it needs to be rethought. And not only that, but if you cannot get that kind of thinking, then you will do better no matter how much emotional trauma it may cause you at the moment. It will be better to sever that relationship and look elsewhere and find somebody who views marriage as a permanent arrangement, or you're destined for heartache. It's also evidenced by the change in vows in recent years that some would like to have. I have actually refused to perform a couple of wedding ceremonies because I was not allowed to say what I believed about the matter. And if I'm going to say it, we're going to say it the way God says it. And if we're not going to do it that way, then you can find somebody else to do it. And I will burn the certificate that they sent to me so that I can't perform it if I can't get out of it any other way. That's how strongly I feel about the situation in regard to what needs to be said, even in a marriage ceremony. This idea that we are going to remain married as long as we both shall love is not permanent. I'll just tell you, all of us know too many cases and too many instances where there are people who have used that to walk out of what they call a loveless marriage, where they have decided that they love somebody else and they simply leave their companion and feel no responsibility toward that marriage at all. In some others, it has been stated that it's for all of our married life. Well, you know, on the surface, that sounds pretty good. It's just the idea is if we choose not to be married, then we don't have to love one another anymore. And that's not what God has said. It also takes away from the seriousness of choosing a mate, and it removes the necessity of kind of working out problems when they arise in the marriage. I mean, after all, we live in such a disposable society that for most of us, let me ask you, you got one of those little Walkmans that you can hook on your belt and stick here in your ear so you can go deaf? You got one of those things? If that thing breaks, what do? You take it in and get it fixed? Inevitably, you don't do that. I'll tell you what happens. It's as cheap to go buy another one as to try to repair that one most of the time. You remember the Sunday morning that our meeting started this year? You remember how we had to cancel Bible study because the electricity went out? And I told you it sounded like it was right here between the house and the building. We've got one of those cordless phones at the house, and it ran in on that thing, and it wouldn't hold the channel anymore. You couldn't use that. You'd be talking to somebody, and all of a sudden, it'd just go off who knows where, and you'd be done. We took that in, and we said, what do you do to fix this? And they said, well, you give it to us, and you pay us so much money, and we'll send you a brand new one, because it's as cheap to make a brand new one as it is to fix this one. We live in a disposable society. And as a result of that, marriage has become a disposable item for some. Whenever problems arise, rather than going and knuckling down and trying to work the situations out, we find it much more convenient just to throw it away and decide we'll start all over with somebody else. Marriage is a permanent arrangement. Not only that, but let me say something about the idea that if we want the home to be what God wants it to be, it needs to be peaceful. After all, nobody wants to live with a nagger, and nobody wants to live with a brute. That's all there is to it. Do you really like to be nagged? You do that a lot if you got kids, don't you? I mean, you're always telling them to do something. And nobody wants to be living with a brute, somebody that's just trying to constantly force their will on. The peaceful home is viewed in the Scriptures in some very poetic passages that maybe would produce some amount of titillation among our young people. You can look at the 128th Psalm, for example, and the peacefulness of the family structure is pictured poetically there for the man, where the father labors, the mother is pictured as the fruitful vine, and children as olive sprouts. Now, I got to admit, that is a rather odd kind of wording for most of our society today, but nonetheless, that pictured the kind of peaceful arrangement for the family. When you look at the woman, can you think of a better passage than Proverbs 31, verses 28 through 31, where her children rise up and call her blessed, and where she is praised by her husband? You see, this is the kind of peaceful, harmonious atmosphere that God has designed in the home. And I would suggest that it involves a number of things. It involves leaving mother and father, as we've already talked about in our study. It involves showing common courtesy. Let me suggest that the husband and the wife need in the marriage to retain those attitudes of courtship. Do you remember when you used to court your companion? How that you used to really be interested in the things that he or she was saying? Do you remember how you hung on their every word? Do you remember how you fixed yourself up? You wanted to look just right when you were with that person, when you really were interested about what they wanted to do and where they wanted to go. You remember those kind of things? That needs to continue in the marriage. And if it does, it helps to produce this peaceful relationship that are there. It also involves the fact of teaching some of this quality to our children, that they need likewise to be able to understand the roles that God has assigned within the family. It is a hard thing to do, but somebody that's been very successful in the family, and quite often when I find people that are that way, I always try to pick their brain for a little advice. And one of the families that have been very successful that I have known in the rearing of their children, when I asked them in regard to those matters, what they said was that in our home, we tried to teach our children that they could say anything that they wanted to say, provided they remembered who they were talking to when they said it. They could disagree with us. They could disagree with the principles or the ideas or the rules that we laid down. But they had to remember that we were mother and father. And they could disagree and voice that disagreement, and as long as they stayed within those bounds, all would be well. And I think that probably is a pretty good rule of thumb, because it allows young people to explore into some areas and to question some things that they legitimately question in right kind of ways. I think also, if you want a peaceful, harmonious relationship, there has to be the recognition of a confession of faults and the seeking at times of forgiveness. That's not only true of your companion, that's sometimes true with our children. If you've made a mistake, if you've blundered, seriously, rather than just ignoring it or covering up, it's a whole lot better to go to that companion, to go to that child, and say, I was wrong. Or maybe, I sinned. Forgive me. You will be a bigger person in their eyes, and you will contribute to the peace and the harmony that God intends for the home. One more thing, and I'm running out of time, and that is, if we're ever going to develop the home as God intends for it to be, it's going to have to be a pious home. I would suggest to you that no home can be too pious. I realize our society makes fun of that. I realize that it is used in the idea of insincerity because somebody is pious. But nonetheless, the goal of the home is to be a blessing. And it ought to be a blessing both to the community in which it is found as well as to the congregation of which those people are a part. And you know, whenever you have a pious home, it comes because you have a husband and a wife who are committed to God. Can you think of a better illustration of that than you can find in Aquila and Priscilla as they're related to us in the pages of the New Testament? There, for example, in the 18th chapter of the book of Acts or in Romans 16, verses 3 through 5. And you know, one of the things inevitably that was said by Paul about this couple in the New Testament was this: the church met in their house. Let me ask you, ladies, how many of you would have been willing to have had this assembly in your home tonight? How hard would you have worked to have got your house ready for all of us to have come into your home just for worship tonight? And you stop and think, here, Aquila and Priscilla did that everywhere they went. They did that in Ephesus, they did that in Rome, and it appears they did that likewise when they dwelt in Corinth. They were people who opened their door so that the church could meet, so that people could learn about God. I would suggest to you that demonstrates people who have a great commitment toward God, most certainly. Also, I would suggest that faithful attendance in assemblies such as we've been involved in today is one of the great legacies that we can give to our children. The fact that it's just known and understood that when Lord's Day evening or Lord's Day morning or Wednesday evening or gospel meetings come, where we're going to be is in the assemblies of the saints. Unless we are providentially hindered, that's where we're going to be. Our desire is there. Our intention is to be there because of our love for God. What greater inheritance could you give to your children? What greater memories can you give to them as they go out on their own than that kind of home life? What kind of atmosphere do we maintain in the home? Is it one where there's good literature? Is it one where there are wholesome associations that are found? Let me ask you, if your children came through your home and saw you either reading the Bible and studying it or in prayer, whether they vocalized it or not, would it go through their minds, wonder who died? Or is that just the normal matter of what they would see and expect in your home? Because that's a part of your home, a part of your home life. And it's not out of place whatsoever, because it is a part of the commitment that you have made to God. And along this line, don't be afraid of overexposing your children to religion. I've never seen it. In any other area, we don't reason like that at all, do we? We don't worry about overexposing them to education. We don't worry about overexposing them to the Bengals. I mean, after all, they all want to have red eyes from crying when the Saints beat them. We don't want to worry about them being overexposed to the doctor or to the dentist or whatever. We see that all of that's done, and it's done when it needs to be done. But all of a sudden in religion, somebody says, oh, I'm afraid I'm going to overexpose my kids to that. Let me suggest to you that that's the kind of exposure that counts.